Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll be starting in a moment and then speak with Senator George McGovern, who was the United States Senator representing South Dakota. In 1972, he was the Democratic Party's presidential candidate and, of course, was defeated by the incumbent Richard Nixon. He's the author of a new book, The Essential America, Our Founders and the Liberal Tradition. We'll talk with Dr. Ben Barber, who has a book, Fears, Empire, War, Terrorism, and Democracy. Ben Barber was a part of President Clinton's Brains Trust, and he is the head of the Democracy Collaborative, and the author of Jihad versus McWorld, a very seminal book that came out before 9/11 and was subsequently considered very prescient. Robert Parry, a 27-year veteran investigative journalist, the author of Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty, From Watergate to Iraq. Senator McGovern, you ran against President Nixon in 1972. You were the Democratic challenger. Some people say that we have a similar situation in the extent to which you have a Republican incumbent challenged by a Democrat at a time of war. Do you see any other analogies to 72 and 2004?
I think the one you mentioned is obvious. We've got an unpopular, divisive war going in Iraq, just as we had in Vietnam 35 years ago. We have no more business being in Iraq with our army than we did in Vietnam. And I think that issue, while it hasn't been discussed as copiously as I had hoped, nonetheless, I think it's perhaps the most important issue in the campaign.
Well, of course, the difference is, Senator McGovern, that it took us till 1975 when in April of 75, we were exiting from the rooftop of the U.S. Embassy. It looks as though, I think, from any reasonable point of view, that we have already lost the war in Iraq. But there's this disconnect between the reality in Iraq and the rosy pictures of what's happening there, at least the apologetic pictures, both from the administration and the press. So I think that's a fundamental difference.
I think that's true. The Vietnam War, from the time we entered to help the French in 1945 until, as you say, we airlifted our remaining people off the roof of the embassy 30 years later, that was a hopeless venture from the very beginning. But I think the hopelessness of this war has become clear much earlier. And the reason for that is that the war was based on two frauds. The fraudulent claim that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction that were targeted on the United States and presented an imminent threat, not just a threat, but one that was right there to the point where the president was unwilling even to let the UN arms inspectors complete their work. He cut them off after a couple of months. Or we might have known that there were no weapons of mass destruction there. The second fraud was giving the impression to the American people that we were fighting terrorism in Iraq. Iraq was not a center of terrorism until we put our army in there. Now they've been picking that army to pieces every day, one, two, three, or four young Americans picked off either by telescopic sight rifles or by car bombs or other devices, but it's still the same hopeless prospect ahead. An inconclusive insurgent guerrilla-type operation that sophisticated Western armies are not equipped to fight.
Well, and again, there not only is there a disconnect in the press, I don't know whether you saw the private email that a Wall Street Journal reporter sent to friends that somehow got circulated on the internet and caused her to be recalled by the Wall Street Journal. It is so much clearer and obviously more accurate and real a reflection of what's happening than what we're getting on the front pages. Furthermore, a poll just came out a couple of days ago by the University of Maryland that said 72% of George W. Bush's supporters, people who are going to vote for him, believe that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They also believe that the rest of the world supports President Bush, and they believe that President Bush's war in Iraq is also supported by the rest of the world.
Well, I've lived quite a few years I've never seen a time in all those years when America's posture in the eyes of the rest of the world was so damaging as it is today. I travel frequently to the far corners of the earth for the United Nations. I've been traveling for so long that it's hard to recall all the experiences. But everywhere I go, even in those countries, a few of them where the leaders endorsed the war, the people are overwhelmingly against it. It's damaging our standing. I can't help but recall a book written by Wendell Willkie in 1941-42. He was defeated by Franklin Roosevelt, probably the best man to run against Roosevelt on the Republican side during those four terms. And Roosevelt asked him to circle the globe and report back what he found, what attitudes and problems. Willkie came back and said, everywhere I went, all around this globe, the greatest source of American power and strength and influence was the attitude of goodwill towards the United States, respect for American ideals, confidence in the judgment of our leaders and our great democracy. I don't think that's true today. I think George Bush has done more, he and Cheney and company and these miserable neoconservatives, to undercut the American posture in the world than we've seen in any previous administration.
Let me again remind the audience I'm speaking with Senator George McGovern, who ran for President of the United States on the Democratic ticket in 1972 against the Republican incumbent, Richard Nixon. George McGovern's book is about how liberalism is essential, an essential American tradition. And you just mentioned strength and power. Strength and power are not the same thing. And it seems to me that our indiscriminate exercise of power in Iraq, ill-conceived and ill-executed as it is actually weakening the country. So it's possible that the use of power can actually undermine a nation's strength.
Absolutely. If that power is unwisely used, it becomes a negative. I suppose the fall of the Roman Empire has been quoted too often, but that great empire used its power in a negative, self-defeating way. It was spread too thin. It was too brutal towards the people it conquered. It even referred to people who were not part of the empire as barbarians. And we're getting some of that same attitude today in this so-called war against terrorism. We get so excited about terrorists that we don't pay enough attention to preserving the constitutional ideals of this country. I think this Patriot Act, for example, which was hastily passed by Congress, urged on by the administration, ought to be called the Anti-Bill of Rights Act. It undermines the very freedoms that the president says we're fighting for. He says the reason the terrorists hit us because they hate our freedom. I don't believe that was what led them to hit us. They didn't have any excuse to hit us under any condition. But to whatever extent that has any truth, we don't want to use the fear of terrorism, if their objective is to undermine our freedom, to undermine our freedom ourselves by things like the Patriot Act and this huge new bureaucracy, a huge white elephant, I call it, that's called Homeland Security. We need to keep our eye on our own enduring values. That's what my book is all about. I call the reader to look back and examine the writings of the founding fathers, all the way down to Abraham Lincoln, who wasn't a founder, but who saved the Union in the Civil War. And what you find in those views of Jefferson and Madison and Tom Paine, one of the first prophets of American democracy, you find the basis for our democratic society, and we ought to cling to those things no matter how many terrorists may threaten.
Well, I think I've always thought that all of the definitions of liberal and conservative in this country are somewhat turned on their head. If you look at the recent era since World War II, all of the great, or actually go back to World War II, all of the great challenges that this nation has faced, the liberals have actually dealt with them. The conservatives always just said no, like Nancy Reagan used to say. They simply didn't bring anything to the table. They were against intervening and stopping Hitler, and that turned out to be absolutely critical for this nation and the world's survival. They were against women's rights, civil rights, labor rights. We would have, if we wouldn't have solved, not completely, but at least partially solved the race problem in this country, we would have been torn apart. The conservatives didn't bring anything to the table. They just said no, no, no. And yet I don't understand why liberals are on the defensive. They are actually the pragmatists. And the conservatives are the dreamers. They talk about shining cities on the hill and this atavistic vision of a country that never was.
Well, you're absolutely right. I say in my book that we need two great traditions in America, conservatism on the one hand and liberalism on the other. But I point out that while conservatives sometimes provide a useful critique of liberal initiatives, the fact is that every single public program now generally endorsed by both political parties, both of the major parties, began as a liberal initiative over conservative opposition. Whether you're talking about the Homestead Act, the Land Grant College Act of the Wilson of the Lincoln administrations, or coming on down through the graduated income tax of Woodrow Wilson's administration, the New Deal with its Social Security, Medicare, rural electrification, and then on into the Kennedy-Johnson years, the great triumph of civil rights in this country, to say nothing about the environmental movement, the women's movement. All of these things have been liberal initiatives. And I think this onslaught against liberalism that began with Joe McCarthy in the 1940s after World War II, I think it's a disgrace that this great tradition of Jefferson and Jackson and Lincoln and Wilson and all the others has been the victim of a steady onslaught in recent decades.
Again, let me remind the audience I'm speaking with to Senator George McGovern, who ran for President of the United States in 1972. He has a new book, which we're offering up for a $100 pledge to 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. The book, The Essential America, Our Founders and the Liberal Tradition. We spoke earlier about the disastrous misadventure in Iraq and the Bush foreign policy, but let me just focus for a moment on domestic, the fact that the Congress and the Senate have become appendages of the White House. They march in lockstep. Forget about the Founding Fathers, the separation of power, oversight, advice, and consent. In effect, Senator McGovern, we have a sham democracy today where the Republican majority pushes through bills on a party line. They exclude the Democrats in conference, where the bills are loaded with special interest goodies, like the $140 billion corporate giveaway last week that was so laden with pork that the bill was 1,200 pages longer. And what did the Republicans do? They changed the font and made it 900 pages. Then they dumped it in the Democrats' lap a few days before voting, a few hours before voting, in fact. So that is not the Congress and the separation of powers that we used to be taught about in civics.
Well, one of the geniuses of American democracy has been the separation of powers. The Founding Fathers were careful to lodge certain powers in the Senate, certain in the House, certain powers in the executive branch, and certain in the Supreme Court. But I don't think there's been a time, at least in my memory, when all of those powers were dominated as they are today by a negative, backward-looking administration leadership. And I think that's a danger to our democracy. I'm not against honest-to-goodness conservatives. I don't often agree with them, but take a man like Pat Buchanan. Pat is a thoroughgoing conservative, and I will wager, I haven't had a chance to read his book yet, that he detests these so-called neoconservatives. The trouble with these neoconservatives is that they seem to be interested in nothing but the exercise of power abroad. They have little or no interest in the domestic scene except to use it to feed their power grabbing abroad. So what I would like to see, I'd like to see a healthy, vigorous conservatism in this country, and I'd like to see an equally healthy, vigorous liberalism. That's when American democracy goes at its best. Let me just say one thing more. I've always had great faith in the United States Supreme Court. Even when they handed down unpopular decisions like the so-called busing decisions of the 1970s, I stood with them. And I used to tell audiences, look, there may come a time when you and I we'll have to rely on that court in the last instance. Let's not undermine the integrity of our court. And what did we have in the year 2000 in this garbled, mixed-up election mess in Florida? We had a United States Supreme Court taking jurisdiction over something they had no right to take jurisdiction over, a state election in Florida, and in a sense, on a 5-4 decision, awarding the election to the candidate who had the fewest votes, 550,000 less votes than Al Gore. That shook me up, as has no other Supreme Court decision in memory.
Well, there's an expectation we may have an equal and similar, in fact, a greater mess in this one, because there's been such an enormous number of new voters brought in largely by the Democrats. The paperwork's not being processed. There's a lot of voter suppression going on, and there's an expectation that the lawyers are going to be there. A lot of people will be challenged. Mm-hmm. Apparently, that's legal. It's extraordinary that these things go on in this democracy of ours. It looks like we're heading for a big mess. But just in the last question to you, Senator, I know that you have to go. Again, you know, I mentioned earlier that we don't have a functioning democracy because the Republican Congress have basically become messenger boys for the president, and they don't exercise advice and consent and separation of power and, at the very least, oversight. There's also a new phenomenon in American politics that started during the Clinton administration. I remember seeing you for years debating William F. Buckley, and there was that kind of Yale club kind of polity to what what conservatives and liberals used to represent. And there's a tradition in this country, you know, if you win an election, you get to govern while the other side goes off and licks their wounds and comes back 4 years later with a better argument. It seems to me that what we learned from Clinton is that there's a permanent attack machine out there that basically is designed to diminish the incumbent's ability to govern. And if, as I expect will happen, that John Kerry becomes the next president of the United States, unless the House and Senate change hands, and they have the subpoena power out of the hands of these Republican Clinton haters, we will have the same problem with Kerry, which is that he'll be hounded by special prosecutors, all of his cabinet members will be hounded, and his ability to govern will be ground to a halt.
Well, I fear that too. If I could just advance one positive note, I've been pretty critical here today. There are always some hopeful, constructive, sound judgments expressed by people somewhere in this country. After that debacle of the Supreme Court on the Florida election, John Paul Stevens, a justice appointed to the court, not by a liberal Democrat, but by President Gerald Ford, he said sadly after that decision was announced, "We may never know who won the election for the presidency in the year 2000, but we certainly know who the loser was. It was the court." John Paul Stevens speaks for me. And there are always people like that. They may not be in a majority, but those voices are out there So I don't give up hope. I continue to think that I was lucky enough to be born in the greatest country on earth, and I don't intend to quit trying to make that country live up to those ideals to the very best of my ability. So we don't want to get so critical that we talk ourselves into feeling it's just no use, the country's going to hell. I think this country still has a lot of greatness left, and institutions like your radio programs, that the outreach of public television and NPR and C-SPAN, some of these other things, still give me hope that America's going to find itself.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Senator McGovern, and for your new book, The Essential America, Our Founders and the Liberal Tradition. And you are building a library, the George and Eleanor McGovern Library and Center for Public Service. And if people who are interested in that can reach the website, which is www.mcgovernlibraryoneword.com. I thank you again.
Thanks so much to you, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Senator George McGovern, who ran for President of the United States in 1972 against the incumbent Richard Nixon. There's some similarities to what we have today, where we have a Democratic challenger trying to unseat a Republican incumbent at a time of war. And, of course, as we've mentioned there, the war in Iraq is already, for all intents and purposes, lost. It took a lot longer, from 72 to 75, to lose the war in not that they hadn't lost it earlier, but to get out of Vietnam. Let's go to the second guest, Ben Barber, who is joining us here. Ben is the Gershon and Carol Kess Professor of Civil Society and distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland. He's a principal of the Democracy Collaborative and internationally renowned political theorist. He's among his books are, of course, Jihad versus McWorld, a very prescient book that came out well before 1995, well before the 9/11 disaster. And but of course, the 9/11 disaster reinforced much of the trends that, particularly the jihad scenarios that we were so blind to, although they were out there. And his new book, Fears, Empire, War, Terrorism, and Democracy, has now been published in paperback. Ben Barber, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you again, Ian.
And we've spoken quite a bit over the years. Pat Buchanan, his newspaper, by the way, his magazine, The American Conservative, has basically endorsed Kerry. And their editorial, written by a guy called Scott McConnell, really rips into George Bush in a way that particularly into his foreign policy being captured by the neoconservatives is quite extraordinary. They more or less say that they're, as Richard Pearl once said, you know, the great thing about George Bush is that there's not much to him, so it's easy to implant ideas in his head because there's a lot of empty space inside his skull. So what's your feeling about whether there's going to be some kind of consequences to this outrageous capture of American foreign policy and the consequent disasters that it's brought about? Is there a chance that reality is going to catch up to us here? Because the reality of what they've done in Iraq is so much worse than what I think most people in this country recognize.
Well, you know, starting back where you were a few minutes ago, you were talking about the need that there be laws against some of the scandalous kinds of gossip and rumor mongering that goes on both the far left and, of course, on the right. And, you know, the trouble is, of course, there are no laws against stupidity in this country, and there's a lot of stupidity around. But one of the great things about Americans, I think, is that ultimately most Americans, I think the great majority really, are, even when they get involved in ideological quarrels and polarized and they see themselves as liberals or conservatives, in the end, we have a strong pragmatic streak. We are kind of realists. We look out there and we want our politicians, whether we're on the right or the left, to have some sense of what's going on in the world. And then, of course, to try to address the world from the point of view of our ideological standpoint. And I think the real problem with this administration and with President Bush has been the unwillingness to actually confront the realities that are out there. I mean, you can argue there's a place for a hard-nosed kind of warlike approach, but you've got to recognize what's out there and see what's working and what's not working. And the problem with this administration, both on the economy and particularly, of course, in world politics and on terrorism in Iraq is that they simply are refusing to acknowledge what Americans of every political stripe are seeing on their television sets every night. You can't go on saying we're winning a wonderful war on behalf of democracy in Iraq, the Iraqis are so grateful to us, this is a big success, when you see Americans slaughtered every day, hostages being taken every day, the number of insurgents multiplying. There was a report just 2 days ago that it wasn't 2,000 or 3,000 insurgents, but probably 12,000 or 15,000 insurgents now that we're trying to fight in Iraq. Americans can't look at that and then be told, hey, no problem, everything is fine. Same thing on the economy. You cannot have a country in which people know their brother-in-law has lost his job, their sister has a new job, to be sure, one of Bush's new jobs, but unlike her old job, there's no pension, there's no insurance, it's at half the price she was making before, half the wage she was making before, and then tell them, hey, the economy's growing, everything's fine. You just can't go on lying to people about realities that are in front of their eyes, and that's the main reason why I'm actually hopeful about this election, because I just think there are too many Americans of whatever political coloration who have gotten fed up with an administration that they might agree with ideologically, but that refuses to see the world for what it is.
Well, the problem is, I mean, you, at some point or other, in order to maintain your sanity, there have to be some kind of agreed-upon reality. This is the problem where you've got, willful ignorance on the right that's encouraged by the administration get elected. They're basically keeping reality at bay.
Ian, you can't keep reality at bay when the television sets on which you're trying to convey your version of reality, when you get through talking, show a series of images that undo what you're saying. It's a little like what happened in the first debate when the very Fox News channel that is responsible for spreading the lies of the right, also in the name of, you know, good television and entertaining television, insisted against the rules of the debate on broadcasting the cutaways, which showed Bush looking uptight and cantankerous and unpresidential in ways that really hurt him badly. That was done by Fox, you know. So the Americans who were being told by Fox that Bush is your man were being shown images by Fox that said something quite different. And the same is true, you know, in the daily cable news networks that are, on the one hand, pushing the message editorially that Bush is giving us, that everything is fine and hunky-dory and, you know, going very well, with their actual news programs that are showing us a series of catastrophes, both abroad and in America, you know, from the flu shots to new jobs without pensions and without insurance to the daily catastrophes that take place in Fallujah and Mosul and in Baghdad. And that's a reality that we're being shown every day. So, you know, it's not as if Bush is actually controlling the media that way. He's controlling the media message on the cable, right? But he's not controlling the images. And the images are very powerfully saying, this guy is lying to you. And that I think, is going to change the character of the election, particularly for those in the middle who are trying to make up their minds who to vote for.
Well, I think in the case of Fox fact that they did show cutaways, they were the pool camera for the first one, and I think the rest of the media probably had some say in that, and they came up with a simple answer, which was to split the screen. Let me again remind the audience, I'm speaking with Ben Barber, he's the author of Fear's Empire, War, Terrorism, and Democracy. One of the things I find really difficult to swallow, Ben Barber, is that we have, the Democrats have got to stop giving credit for their political demise to Bush's brain, they call him, Karl Rove. They need to stop being mugged on the high road by Karl Rove while giving George W. Bush the right of way on the low road.
Yeah, that's right. Look, our fate in this election is actually in our own hands. We know the demographics of America have long since favored the Democrats, but we know far too many people who would be Democrats if they registered and voted haven't registered and voted. This year, as we all know, there's been a massive campaign through ACT and through other 527s to register new Democrats. There are probably up to 4 million of them registered, and if even half of them turn out, if they turn out at the same rate the general electorate turns out, I think we stand a very, very good chance to win, particularly in states like Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, Michigan, Wisconsin, those battleground states where the election is likely to be decided. So we are in a position to do it. We can't do it if we do it by a slight margin. We saw in the year 2000, this is always true in politics, if you don't win decisively, you open the door to all kinds of cheating and scandal mongering and the kinds of things that happened in 2000. The only way to be sure that the people, the Republicans standing at the door trying to stop our voters from voting, is that enough do it that it won't matter even if they get away with some of that. So we've got to win decisively, and to win decisively means we have to guarantee that our constituency turns out and turns out big, and that's, of course, where a lot of the effort, the money, and the demographic effort of people coming in from out of state to the battleground states is going to go, all of which suggests to me that we actually are in a very strong position here if we ourselves take the responsibility and don't let ourselves get talked into the notion that somehow the media and Karl Rove and the manipulators have pulled a fast one on America that doesn't let us win.
Well, that's exactly what the current strategy of the Republicans is, and they somehow, I think, have gotten the pollsters to work with them. That unfortunately, Democrats and liberals are very faint of heart. They're easily discouraged. They think the machines are going to be stacked against them, the deck stacked against them. They believe that they're already losing. That's an essential Republican strategy to tell you.
I'm not sure, Ian. Where I, you know, with the people I've talked with, and I've been talking to a lot of people on the ground in the battleground states. They are excited. They are optimistic. Right. And above all, a lot of them, particularly ones who lived there and got screwed last time in places like Florida, they are angry. And they are saying, our vote is going to count this time, and we're going to be sure it counts, and we're going to get everybody out. And as you know, there are Democratic lawyers in the districts as well as Republicans. There are resources there to make sure that voters can get to the polls, that people who don't have transportation will get there. There's a lot of excitement and also, as I say, a lot of real anger, saying that we're not going to let it happen again this time. So I frankly am getting, particularly from the battleground states, a sense of real hope. I mean, you know, Roosevelt also said you can fool some of the people all the time and all the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. And I think this kind of fooling the people that has been the mainstay of Republican politics for the last 4 years and Karl Rove's machine has really run its course. I mean, you can't go on saying black is white and white is black and victory is defeat and defeat is victory. I mean, you just can't do that. People can use their own eyes. They see what's on television. They see what in states like Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin, where heavy unemployment has been offset a little bit by new jobs. You don't have to go in, as Kerry is, and tell these people, yeah, you got new jobs, but it's half the wage and with no pensions and no health care this time compared to the old jobs these are supposed to be replacing. People know that. It's in their lives. It's their cousins and their sons and brothers. You know, same with the National Guard. National Guardsmen know they're getting screwed. They know there's no body armor for them. They know because they're taking up collections in places like Canton and Akron, Ohio, to buy body armor for their loved ones who are over in Iraq, so they don't even have to have Kerry tell them that they don't have the wherewithal to defend themselves in Iraq. That's a fact on the ground. So, I mean, my feeling is these lies kind of have run their course, and reality is catching up. And sure, there's a whole bunch of folks out there on the ideological right who aren't paying attention, but among those who haven't yet decided, and they're the ones who will decide this election, they're precisely the ones who are looking carefully at the lies, who are looking at the reality in front of them. And I think the fact that they haven't committed to Bush to this point is a very good omen for John Kerry.
Well, I just wanted to clarify, though, what I was saying, Ben Barber, about Karl Rove and the idea that we keep attributing everything to Bush's brain, Karl Rove. Rove is not so much Bush's brain, he's Bush's cover. This is what offends me about Bush, is he hides behind the sleaze that he's equally, if not more, responsible for. It used to be said in politics that the race goes to the swiftest, as in Swiftboat, but the race today goes to the sleaziest. So they have this tactic of planting lies in the press, and then when the wounded party protests, you shout them down with more lies until the waters are so muddied you can't tell serving from shirking, duty from desertion, a patriot from a parasite, a hero from a coward. And so instead of comparing Bush's incomplete Texas Air National Guard record with Kerry's decorations for combat in Vietnam, they've sidetracked us into a debate between Kerry and the Swiftboat veterans.
Yeah, but obviously, I think that's July's news.
I understand.
Maybe August's news. I think October's news is that the war is going badly in palpable ways that every American can see and feel every night on television. Even President Bush in one of his debates said rather faintly and weakly, well, I know the war has some problems. I watch television, too, he said. It was pathetic in a way, the way he said it. But, I mean, the fact is the polls that showed 15 and 12-point separation in favor of Bush following the Republican convention and following the Swift Boat lies and that campaign have now all have completely vanished. And what we see instead, even based on polls, which, as you rightly said a few moments ago, are not very accurate because they all the polling we're seeing is from registered voters and people who voted last time, people who are heavily weighted towards the Republicans, and new voters and people without home lines and people who use just cells or people who are homeless but are going to vote and so on. They're not being counted at all. The fact is, even with the polls that distorted, it's showing a even heat between the two candidates, which is a radical change from just 6 weeks ago. So, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that even the polls are suggesting that a lot of Americans in the middle are catching up to these lies, not buying them anymore, and have either gone back into Kerry's camp, where for a while they were in Bush's camp, or at least remain undecided. And historically, a vote that's undecided up to the last week in a race where an incumbent is running for office, that's bad news for the incumbent, because normally you don't have undecided. Normally people say, well, I know. If people are saying just a week before, I don't know if I can support this president, that's bad news for the president.
Well, I agree. I think that the 4 million extra Christian right votes that Rove said they didn't get last time and that they're going to get this time, because after all, the president signals to these people all the time. He's mentioning of the Dred Scott decision is a clear indication that they're trying to equate Dred Scott with Roe v. Wade. He does signal to his base all the time, but it would seem to me that whatever they pick up in terms of more of the Christian right, they're going to lose from the moderate Republicans. And my feeling is that there is going to be an inevitable showdown in the Republican Party between the Christian conservatives and the moderate traditional Republicans. And also, furthermore, Ben, I think we're heading into this country between the red and the blue, another sort of Mason-Dixon line where eventually I think the Democrats may well pick up these moderate Republicans like Senator Snow, Collins, Chafee, McCain. They may well eventually join Jim Jeffords.
That's exactly right. And also, by the way, I mean, people, we've sort of, in the noise of the main presidential race, we've sort of forgotten about the Senate race. But the fact is, we actually just said the Democrats have an opportunity to win back the Senate. And that will be absolutely crucial. Should we lose the presidency, having the Senate will prevent some of the damage from being done. And as is very likely, if we win the presidency, we will need the Senate to get a Kerry agenda, at least in part, enacted. So those races are important, too. And surprisingly, again, that's really going quite well. And even the Republicans have admitted that in places like North Dakota with Tom Daschle and others, they've just absolutely got to win that race, even though that's going to be tough for them, because if they don't, they may well lose the Senate as well. I'm not trying to be Panglossian here, but I mean, I think most of the hidden factors favor the Democrats, and most of the overt factors that are out there show at best or worst a dead heat between them. So, I mean, I think we need to take heart and not be, as you say, the way liberals too often are, faint-hearted, and instead really throw ourselves into this and make sure that we have every opportunity to use all of the opportunities that are in place to secure a victory, not just in the presidency in the White House, but also in the Senate.
Well, it's a surprise that the seat in the Republican Senate seat in Kentucky is now up with Bunting, who's, from all intents and purposes, has lost his mind. So,
well, Colorado too, by the way.
Yeah,
I mean, there are places. Like that. So, we don't want to expend our short-term resources to win a short-term victory and then at the same time rob the long-term resources that are part of the education in this country, that are part of the long political struggle, because even a Kerry victory and a Democratic victory in the Senate is going to leave this country with a great many problems and California with a lot of problems.
But just in closing, Ben, I wanted to go back to this feeling that I have that there's going to be a permanent divide in this country, and it's between the red and the blue. The coasts are going blue, the heartland red. Obviously, if you could get rid of the Electoral College, then American politics in the 21st century would be simple. The popular vote would ensure a blue state majority. But underlying this divide is a very unhealthy divide between the secular and the theocratic, the modern and the medieval, engagement and isolation, and knowledge and dogma.
Well, you know, there is that, but again, I think the politics of the Electoral College and the politics of what is really a minority group controlling the Republican Party right now make the polarization seem worse than it is, because the fact is, of course, there's been for a long time in America, going all the way back to the 19th century, a 15-25% group of people who are deeply religious, whose politics is highly ideological, and who haven't been part of the mainstream. Indeed, when the president was talking about Dred Scott, I thought that was a symbol, a sign that he had said finally the Republican Party had caught up at least to the Civil War.
I'm afraid it's not quite that benign.
Much beyond that. But no, that's my way of being, of saying that in fact, though there's a minority who are that way, I think the great majority of Americans, and particularly the new America that lives in cities, the new America made that's non-white, I mean, your state of California is the first state to have a majority of minorities. There's no longer a white majority or any other majority there. Texas is headed that way. Florida is headed that way. New York's headed that way. We are a nation of diversity. We are a nation where many women work. Many women head their own households, where couples are of a diverse nature. Some are straight. Some are heterosexual and homosexual. There's many, many different kinds of people now. And I think increasingly, demographically, that will dominate America. We're lagging behind because our 19th century political system favors the rural states, favors the old white Anglo-Saxon Protestant parts of America. But those parts are in the minority. And long term, I think we will be served by a political system that reflects that. The question is, can we survive the short term while old, traditional white Southern America continues to dominate our politics, while this new America is beginning to get its act together and seize the vote? And that's why this election is so important, because if in this election we can say we finally have a government now that represents the majority of what America is, the global America, the multicultural America, the diverse America, the America with open borders, you know, then we can say that our political system will have finally caught up to the demographic realities of America. And that's, I think, where we're heading. And if we can win this election, it'll be a great forward move.
But as you mentioned, the 19th century political mechanism we have with the Electoral College is obviously out of date. But how do you explain, though, that the image of the American family is basically this Aussie and Harriet image that is completely at odds with the census? The last census indicated that over 75% of Americans live in outside of the traditional nuclear family, and that we are a nation that's sort of making up our own families. There are mixed races, mixed marriages, mixed genders. You know, people are finding their own way, and yet the moral minority is imposing upon us this atavistic vision of a perfect Aussie and Harriet world that has nothing to do with the American reality.
Exactly, and another sign that our political realities, confined by an 18th and 19th century political system, it's not just the Electoral College, it's also the Senate, which over-represents rural, underpopulated states exactly the way the Electoral College does. You know, we have a political system that isn't really a majoritarian system, and there are some virtues in that. It prevents runaway majorities and so on, but it also prevents real representation of who we have become, particularly because of this oddity that in so many ways our new population, whether it's immigrants, whether it's the poor, whether it's the homeless, whether it's ex-felons trying to get a new start, whether it's women who are heading their own households, and who are working full-time and don't have time to vote. So many of these new voters that represent the new American majority, are new citizens who represent the new American majority, are not voters, are not voting. And that's why the registration campaigns, the turnout campaigns are so very vital, because there is a simple factual majority of people, and you've just cited some statistics on families and so on, that really are in a new place, but the political system hasn't caught up. And a lot of the efforts this year in the political campaign and among Democrats and in registration and in Florida and Ohio and Colorado have been to help find ways to assure that this new American majority is actually engaged in the political, is registered to vote, and on November 2nd gets to the vote, gets to the polls and votes. And if that happens, and when that happens, then we will have a political system and a political government that reflects who we are in our majority, and this minority of Americans who are living in a different century, in a different time zone, and in some ways in a different universe, will no longer be in a position to dominate our politics, and maybe can start thinking about the need to accommodate themselves to the new universe in which we live.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Ben Barber, for your book, Fear's Empire. And fear is the glue that binds President George W. Bush to the electorate, and fear is a very unhealthy bond to guide a nation. And your book is an essential reading in terms of understanding how far off we have become, how we have been goaded into an endless war by a hopeless cave-dwelling fanatic. And this is not, as we were saying earlier with Senator McGovern, there is a difference between strength and power, and the indiscriminate and ill-advised use of power can undermine a nation's strength. Again, I thank you, Ben.
Great to be with you, Ian, and let's make the new America.
Again, I thank you. And now we're going to go to Lou DeBose, the author of the just-published The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress. Lou's going to be talking to us about The Hammer, who is Tom DeLay. And Tom DeLay, of course, was subpoened this week. Prior to that, for the last couple of weeks, he's been censured by the House. This is a House that he controls. The fact that he was censured at all indicates that there's probably a lot more to it, given that only in the House of Representatives can you be guilty of either unethical or criminal behavior. You get tried or examined behind closed doors, and the content of this examination is sealed. So we really have no idea. Lou DeBost, do you have any idea what really has been going on in the House in these ethics committees? Because the records are all sealed, right?
They are all sealed. I don't know. I think Joel Hefley, the chair of the ethics committee, must have been under enormous pressure, because a reprimand by the House Ethics, an admonishment by the Ethics Committee, is almost unheard of, because it really has been dead for 7 years. It has, it's a closed loop. You can't, a Congress, the Republicans and Democrats have declared a truce on three, and so they don't file against each other, and outsiders can no longer file. In 1999, DeLay was reprimanded for pulling a vote off the floor to protest a lobby group hiring a Democratic former congressman. He got a letter, but he wouldn't release the letter, nor would the committee. So we really don't know, except to say that it takes enormous transgressions on behalf of a congressman for that committee to act, because it doesn't act.
Well, obviously there's a... I'm getting a bit of feedback here, but obviously the reason that we're talking about DeLay is that we spend too much of our time talking about Bush and what he's done to the country, and we forget that the House is controlled by, and so is the Senate, by Frist, and the House by DeLay. And these are people who are much more open about their theocratic right-wing Christian belief systems than George W. George W. is able to play the game where he signals to his Christian coalition supporters that he's one of them, but he also, if you saw the Republican convention in New York, they put on a very moderate, secular face that they put out Schwarzenegger here, the governor, who's actually going to be campaigning for Bush this week, and Rudy Giuliani and others like that who don't represent the people who've really captured the Republican Party. But I think the value of your book, Lou, The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress, is to put this front and center. I mean, how come this guy has been getting such a free ride?
It's scary business. They hit him, they kept him under wraps at the convention, of course, because a national media examination of this guy turns up some scary stuff, and I think the press, in a sense, has failed to do our job. I mean, we sat in an extreme right Christian right congregation in San Antonio, listened to Tom DeLay make a speech on Israel that had to do with prophecies that one virulent sect of Christianity's interpretation of revelations, and at the end of it, he said everything that has been said here today has been the word of God. Well, everything that was said there today was that we must have a war in the Middle East in order for the second coming of Christ to occur, and Armageddon must occur. Israel must be, biblical Israel must be reunified. All the Jews in the world must return to Israel. 144,000 Jews will be allowed to survive after the conflagration at Armageddon. Who believes this stuff? Who believes it? It's the strangest, it's the most bizarre Christianity, and it's, they can believe if they want, but it shouldn't be a basis for our foreign policy.
Well, it's, by any definition, it's criminally irresponsible. It borders on being insane. So how do you explain that somehow it's been kept off out of the political game, that nobody wants to take on this notion that people like DeLay and Frist and Bush are criminally irresponsible with this insane theocracy, and that it gets under the cover of religion, they are front for right-wing politics, but of the most virulent and irresponsible type. So can't we call a spade a spade?
Yeah, I wish we could, Ian. I don't know. For one thing, the general perception that religion is a public good, which I don't agree with. I mean, it can be, and it is, and it isn't. In this country, religion is sacrosanct, and you can't touch it. Well, there's good religion, and there's very bad and dangerous religion. I mean, I sat when Bush was running for president. I sat at a prayer breakfast, and he sat next to James Robeson, on whose show he appeared. James Robeson was told us that day about a conversation that he had on the Dallas Fort Worth Turnpike, a conversation with God, and he quoted God and he quoted himself, and then candidate Bush, now President Bush, sat there nodding through this. Well, I don't know that we want a president who believes that God talks to him, because who knows what he's hearing. The same is true with DeLay, only probably more so, because DeLay is farther around the bend with this business than Bush. It's okay. I mean, I think you can believe whatever you believe. But these people are making, he flew to Israel. He flew to Israel in July 2 years ago, on the day Ariel Sharon was flying here to meet with Bush. And while Palestinian Prime Minister Abu Abbas was here in Washington meeting with Bush, Sharon waited for DeLay to arrive before he would fly over here to meet the President of the United States. Then he made a speech in the Knesset, DeLay did, that was so far to the right that embraced unifying the ancient biblical kingdom of Israel, getting rid of the Palestinians, moving them out of their homeland. That Danny Yatom, the former director of Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, publicly said, God, this guy's so far to the right of Likud. He's farther to the right than any of us. This is really, really scary business, and this is of the public record. It's not hidden. I don't know. It drives me crazy.
Well, I tell you, Lou DeBose, the thing that's bad about it is that, or really disturbing, is that American Jews, most of whom are pretty liberal, and even at these Reformed temples, they are urging people to vote for Bush, that he's good for Israel. I mean, it seems to be so far from the truth that these right-wing ideologues haven't brought anything but disaster to this country. And it looks as if pretty clear that they've done the same to Israel. And if going into Iraq was supposed to help Israel, I can't see it how it can at the end of the day help. We have a completely destabilized Middle East and the growth of radicalism exponentially growing and ending up with an Iraq that will make Afghanistan, a failed state, look like a picnic.
You got to give Bush credit for this. You know, he disengaged. They made a calculated decision to stop talking with the Israelis and the Palestinians. And we see, you know, Clinton was at least talking with them and talking very hard. You know, I don't think the Palestinians got such a great deal out of Clinton. If you looked at the map, and I think that maybe perhaps Arafat should not have walked. He should have continued negotiating. But at least they were talking. They weren't killing each other. And now we have Bush disengaging for 14, 16 months before he patched together this roadmap for peace that was, you know, it was ass covering on the eve of the Iraq War because Tony Blair demanded it. And then as soon as we had a peace process begun again, the man to the right of him, the other Texan who hopes to be in Texas in Washington long after Bush has retired to Crawford, Texas, he goes over and he dismantles the peace plan in Israel. I mean, that's almost seditious. This was his president, our country's peace plan. You know, a Democratic congressman flies to Iraq on a fact-finding tour, and McDermott from Washington, and he's called a traitor. This guy goes to Israel and Jordan and dismantles the peace process that the president has put in place, and nobody argues with him because he has that Christian base behind him. And without the Christian base, the Republican Party is not a party. It's a losing party.
Again, I'm speaking with Lou DeBose, the author of The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress. This is essential reading because, as we mentioned earlier, you're missing the boat if you think that this country is just run by George W. Bush. Even though the Congress and the Senate have become a rubber stamp, they march in lockstep with the White House. They don't practice advice and consent anymore in the Senate, and they don't practice oversight in the Congress. They push these bills through. They vote on a party line. They exclude the Democrats. Then they go into conference. The Republican House and Senate go into private conference. They exclude the Democrats. They load these bills up with all kinds of pork, and then they dump them on the lap of the Democrats a few hours before they get to vote. Nobody has a chance to read them. This is a sham democracy we have in the United States today, and we need to know about who these players are. You told me the other day, Lou, that there's a peculiar connection here between Bush and DeLay in the sense that they're both dry drunks. Can you run us through that scenario?
Yeah, you know, I think that maybe the message is beware of drunks. When I do this, I'm going to do a problem. I'm going to do 12 steps, not the one step with Jesus. You know, these are two guys who were both essentially midlife crisis losers. Bush was a drunk, and DeLay was admittedly said he was drinking 12 to 15 martinis a day, or 11 or 12 to 13. Well, you know, the greater the sin, the better the conversion story, and conversion stories are important in the Christian world. But nonetheless, he was a drunk, and both of them, when they found Jesus, they found religion. They seemed to have lost the Christ. Both of them, you know, Billy Graham took care of Bush's conversion because Bush pertains to a class to which Billy Graham ministers. When he wasn't making money off of savings and loan deals, DeLay found it with Focus on the Family, the right wing Christian ministry televangelist out of Colorado Springs. So with a video, appropriately enough, because it's a class bias conversion, Bush got it, you know, first class, and he got it coach class. Right. And ever since finding religion, he refocused, and he is. But bear in mind, these guys, DeLay, to put their Christianity to a test, they set up a work camp. They fought for a work camp in American Saipan in which women were locked behind gates working 36 hours a day, a week, no overtime, for $3 an hour, locked behind concertina wire making garments for American factory outlets. Tom DeLay fought to keep that open and to keep U.S. labor standards out of there. These women won a $9 million lawsuit for recovered wages. The Philippines would not let their women travel to American Saipan anymore. You know, and there were women there were forced to have abortions or leave. They were paying $5,000 to go there to work to labor contractors and then working in a company store, essentially, a company town. And Tom DeLay and Dick Armey, two Christians, DeLay in particular, they did everything they could to keep U.S. labor standards out of there. Now, that doesn't speak very well for Christianity, I don't think.
Well, what's he specifically being was subpoenaed for? It's this Texas case, right?
Right.
Where he... well, you run us through it briefly, Lutebus.
He's got troubles all over the map. The Texas case for which he's being subpoenaed, you know, he came in and spent illegally $700,000 in corporate money. His PAC spent that money to elect a speaker in the state, to elect a state house in Texas, Texas state house, to Republicans, so they could elect a speaker so he could redraw the district lines to in a way that would provide a 5-7 seat advantage for the Republicans in the U.S. Congress. He did it illegally. We know, you know, you don't have to say alleged. They spent corporate money, and someone is probably going to go to jail for it. Three of his top aides have been indicted, as have eight corporations for giving the money. So the Democrats knew that this had happened to them. So in response, they fled the state. They denied the Republicans a quorum. Well, one of the airplanes leaving the state was flown by the former Democratic Speaker of the House. Tom DeLay wanted to know where they were going because he wanted Texas troopers to go arrest them or intercept them. He called the FFA, his office did, on his orders, and suggested that the plane was missing. You know, try calling the FFA and saying a plane is down and give them the tail numbers and tell them to go find it. Do that this afternoon. You know, let one of your listeners try that this afternoon and see what happens to us. He took a government agency designed to protect us, and even the anti-terrorist wing arm of it, and he dispatched it on a political errand to find a Democratic legislator legally flying his private plane, out of the state of Texas. So that's what the lawsuit he was subpoenaed for last week. You know, the impunity doesn't describe with the way we treat this guy, and you know, but I think that. Things look hopeful. I mean, the system, as corrupt and controlled as it is, the DA in Texas has indicted three of these guys, three of his top aides from his own, Tom DeLay's own pack. One of them can go to jail for 99 years in Texas, where you're likely to end up locked in a cell with a guy named Bubba. You know, they might start talking, and those indictments point to Washington.
Lutebus, the author of the just-published The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress.
I thank Louis Vandenberg for the research and producing this program. I thank the engineer, Mark Maxwell. This program can be heard on ianmasters.org on the net, ianmasters, one word, .org. Bye for now.